Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of October 28th. I'm John Gibson, and with me late on a Saturday night is Jim Allen. How you doing, bud?
Late? This is not late.
Dude, it's late.
Okay.
It's yeah, late my, for us normal.
Yeah, my boss last week after Japan played in the Rugby World Cup, and he said, I'm sorry to keep you guys late. And I looked at him like, late? And he said, oh, I'm sorry, late for normal people.
There you go. Late for normals. Yeah.
Okay, I said, okay, I'll buy that.
The season is over.
Yep, it is indeed.
It's over.
And
it's
and
over before it
damn
started.
It was
congratulations
fun.
To the SoftBank Hawks. They won the Japan series, but it's I don't know. It was really weird. It was a really weird. It's Halloween weekend sort of, and we've got I guess a ghost kind of scary theme because it seemed like the Hawks scared the Giants back away or something like that. They were chasing bats, chasing them right out of the dome and or both domes. But anyway,
the Giants bats were doing the chasing. Yeah.
Well, whatever was happening. Anyway, it's over. So on this week's show, we've got the Japan series wrap-up. We're going to discuss the Sawamura Award that wasn't. We've got season highlights, and we're going to handle some high heat. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
All right, so I don't know about you, but for me, this series just it got ugly. I couldn't look. I couldn't watch. I mean, I wanted to watch and I wanted to be excited. And I thought the Giants, I had predicted the Hawks in six. I said, I think the Giants can get a couple games. And you, I think on Twitter, you said, well, how about a gentleman's sweep? And that's the five game series and that, of that variety. And it turns out it was just a nasty, ugly, get out of my face, get out of my house sweep.
Well, as I said, I didn't feel it would be nice to predict a sweep. I also didn't really think a sweep was going to happen because I think the Giants have, you know, when you got one team that's, you know, 20% better than the other, you don't expect them to win all four games.
Yeah. And I didn't. So the Hawks sweep the Giants in a series. It felt like it only took three games.
And oddly enough, it was the last one was the close one, you know, so, oh yeah.
Right. So they win their 10th series title as a franchise overall. It's the first three-peat in NPB since the Cebu Lions from 1990 to 92.
Mm-hmm.
What else are the sexy numbers?
It was bunch. I mean, as for the Hawks, it was the second time the Hawks have played the Giants 11 times, which is the most between any two teams in NPB history. But nine of those times
in the Japan series,
but nine of those were between the Osaka-based Nankai Hawks and the Giants, of which the Giants won eight.
Mm-hmm.
So the only other time they beat the Giants was 1959 when the Hawks swept the Giants.
Yep, 60 years ago, and that was the last time the Hawks swept the Giants in the Japan series.
Correct, and the winning pitcher was Tadashi Sugiura. You may ask, the winning pitchers? No, because Tadashi Sugiura, the Hall of Fame side-armer, won all four games.
Back in 60 years ago, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So this series, like I said, seemed to be over. So we're going to go through the games, but very quickly. And starting with game two, since we taped with the Rugby World Cup ongoing and all that, and we're doing it again on Saturday night with the Rugby World Cup wrapping up here in Japan. But game two, that was at Fukuoka Dome, and that ended the Hawks 6, the Giants 3. Now, I thought that night that Giants manager Tatsunori Hara didn't really seem, in my opinion, to manage with any kind of urgency.
Hmm.
And I know it was a great game, and both pitchers were dueling with the perfect games and then the no-hitters and all that stuff. But it just seemed that when you're down a game in a series, to me,
mm-hmm.
you have to do what you can do. And when you have to do it, make moves so that you can get that game. And I thought, in the seventh inning with Kan Otake on the mound, and he came in after, what was it, six brilliant innings from CC Mercedes,
mm-hmm.
Mercedes pitched really well, and I thought Hara watched Otake, you know, there was an error involved and a hit and run and all that, but I just thought, you know, he's not missing bats or anything, and I can't afford to let them score here in this third run. Their bullpen is too good. In my opinion, I would have made a move and matched up against whatever. Now, I know the hit he gave up to Nobuhiro Matsuda, the home run, was a righty-righty matchup, but I just didn't think Otake was throwing well, so I would have gone to a different right-hander. But Matsuda hits a three-run jack, and it just felt like the game was over at that moment, even though it wasn't, and it ended up being 6-3. It just seemed that just took the wind out of the little Giants.
It was an interesting game. A couple of things I'd note was that Rei Takahashi and Christopher Mercedes, that pitcher's duel was really enticing because they're like two different kinds of attacks, and Takahashi was attacking them in the strike zone, and they just couldn't hit the pitches. And Mercedes was getting guys to chase out of the zone. He was just really locating, I mean, like nobody's business. And then the Hawks, although the Hawks, they took until the seventh inning to score, they had to wait until Mercedes was out of the game. They pretty much started holding his feet to the fire from the fifth inning when they stopped chasing. They made these really big adjustments. And and this is something I noticed throughout the series, was that the Giants were not as quick to adjust as the Hawks were.
Okay.
And it just seemed like, he had to get rid of Mercedes and had to go to Otake because the Hawks were onto him. There really wasn't anything left. He was done. And
I didn't mind the change of the starting pitcher, but I didn't like what I saw from Otake.
And keeping him in the game, right? I mean, there were a couple of those moves where you thought like Hara was lacking inspiration. Like I think that's a motivation or something. I don't know. The interesting thing is the open door for that inning was from Yasuhiro Yamamoto, who came in and he made two errors in the series. The Giants made four errors in four games, which tied a Japan series record for a four-game series. And two of them were by Yamamoto on his first touch of the game when he came off the bench. So he makes an error at third base when who was it who came out? Somebody got hit. Wakabayashi was hit by a pitch in the sixth inning, and so his replacement Yamamoto makes an error to open the Hawks seventh, and that's really all the Hawks needed. But it's also a little microcosm of the series in that the Hawks fielded the ball really well and the Giants didn't.
True.
The Giants, I mean, yeah, so that was, there were lots of little things. I mean, it was like, in what area were the Hawks not better? It's hard to find one.
Right. So, okay.
Other than perhaps in getting Yoshiyuki Kame out. I mean, that was kind of hard after the second game. But
yeah, and yeah, we'll get to him because he seemed like their best weapon, but they didn't really have runners on when he came on, and he wasn't hitting home runs all the time. So.
Yeah, basically the other one was, that was 6-3, but it was 6-3 because they put in Junpei Takahashi, who's just a mop-up guy, in the ninth inning, and the Giants went to the bank against him. So that was that. Okay, let's go on to game three.
Okay, in game three, the scene shifts to Tokyo Dome here, and the Hawks win that one 6-2. Now, I felt like Hara had, how did you frame it? You said he was not,
Not inspired.
Not inspired. And I said he had even less desperation, it seemed like. And it seemed like he was treating the game like one of those regular season opportunities to get some of these young players some really quality postseason experience. Because I wasn't...
Shosei Togo.
Togo, the 19-year-old rookie out of high school, in his, I think it was his fourth time in a first team NPB game. He pitched two regular season games, and this was his second appearance in the postseason. And here he is out there pitching in a big game. And he looked outwardly on the outside. He didn't look flustered or worried or nervous or anything, but the situation is dire, in my opinion, when you could be down 3-0 in the series, and I just wouldn't have gone down that road in the first place. And I guess it just sheds a light on the fact that they didn't have a healthy rotation, or they didn't have guys whom they could really trust to go out there. So Yeah, it, for me that was the biggest thing, and
it was essentially became a bullpen game, and it's like I don't mind a bullpen game if you're using your better pitchers.
Exactly, and I just like I said, just lack of desperation in the moves that Hotto was making, and I just didn't get it.
And this is the game where Yoshiyuki Kame, who had no hits through the first two games, he homered in his first two at bats, and so it was funny because I was thinking all I could think of after that was, and nobody else could get on base, except Alex Guerrero in the seventh spot, and I was thinking, geez, they must be just trying to get the bases loaded so that Kame will come up and he can hit another home run, and that's the Giants' plan in this game. And that's about as feeble, it looked almost that feeble, like that was the only thing they had thinking about. You know, that's how, I'm not saying that was the plan, but it seemed like it. I mean, it seemed like this team doesn't have a plan.
Yes, and see, I like Kame, and I kept, tweeting about how he's amazing and how this is a great thing, the way he's playing. But when you have a guy, in my opinion, when you have a guy hitting that hot and your other guys who I know they've carried you and they've gotten you here, but, you know, you've got Hayato Sakamoto, who was just completely flummoxed out there, and you had Yoshihiro Maru, who just couldn't seem to do anything right. And I don't know who it is you might lead off with, but I would have dropped Kame down in the lineup and tried to get some of those other guys on. And Hayato Sakamoto has hit in the leadoff spot before. I think it would make him even a little bit more patient to walk. But I know he's your big guy. I mean, he had 40 home runs this year. He should be hitting in a what they call quote unquote RBI spot. So I totally understand it, but I just thought desperate times, you know, call for desperate measures and change and do something. Don't just watch the circular motion of the water go down the toilet here.
Well, I don't know if I told you, and I apologize. I don't remember if I told the podcast listeners or I told this to Jason Cosbury at game four, but it's like the Giants came into this series not really believing that the Pacific League is a better league.
Or maybe they just didn't think they could win. I don't know which one it was.
At one point, it's like, and I felt that it was going to be a tough road for them because, you know, you come in with confidence because you're the best team, easily the best team in your league. But facing a motivated team from the PL, that's a much harder, it's a significantly harder competition.
Yeah, and so, I mean, yeah, they started Yuki Takahashi, they went to the bullpen right at signs of trouble, but then they bring in this kid, Togo.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, this is not the guy to get you out of trouble, and that just didn't say to me, well, you're saying, yeah, well, maybe they're just not as good. Maybe Hara thought we can bring in someone whom they haven't seen, and this guy will get, you know, he'll stay
well,
for us.
I mean, he kept doing... He kept bringing in one pitcher to get one out to get out of bad innings in this game. And then he went to that pitcher came out because of a pinch hitter, and the next guy got clobbered. And it was like clockwork.
Yeah, maybe not all of them got clobbered.
No, they didn't all get clobbered, but they all put them, the first guy did, who was Shosei Togo, and the fourth one did Sawamura, who did not pitch well. He didn't give up a run, but he didn't pitch well either. I mean, it was dangerous stuff.
Yeah.
So the Giants bullpen, I mean, you know, which parts of this series went well for the Giants? Well, Christopher Mercedes was really good, and we get to game four, there are a couple of bright spots, but pretty much, you know, the fielding, the base running, the bullpen, the hitting, pretty much you name it. Yeah. The Giants were second best.
Yeah. So I was listening to the radio broadcast during game four, actually, and we'll get to that right here shortly. But I was listening, and Yasushi Tao was doing the color commentary, the former Rakuten first year, the inaugural year manager, and a guy who appears on Pro Yaku News pretty regularly. And does a lot of radio broadcasts as the color analyst. And he was talking about the way the Hawks develop their young players. And this was really interesting. So he said at the beginning, when the guys come in as rookies, they just put them out there on the field and let them play. And the coaches all get together in the preseason. So I guess either after the fall workouts that they do, or the fall camps that they do, and before the spring camps, the coaches all get together, and because they usually have some turnover in those coaches. So mm-hmm. they get them all together and they say, look, leave the players alone. We want them to have confidence when they go out there and just enjoy being professional baseball players, because it's a big change for them. But then when the players run into trouble, which tells that they are inevitably going to run into some kind of problem,
mm-hmm.
The players will go to the coaches and ask for advice.
Mm-hmm.
And so once they do that, it has them very open-minded to accepting change and accepting how to do things differently, because they're obviously having trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They're having some struggles.
Interesting.
And so he said then the coaches give them advice and see which players can implement those adjustments immediately, or how they make the adjustments, or if they make the adjustments.
Mm.
But basically get their mind frame, the mindset right to accept the coaching. And so then they start to develop the players that way and tell them what to work on and what they need to improve on and all that stuff. So I thought that was really, really...
That is interesting, and it's somewhat atypical. And I was thinking about the Hawks coaches because an acquaintance of mine is a batting coach, Yasuo Fuji, for the Oryx Buffaloes, and he, for a couple of years, was the batting coach for the SoftBank Hawks in 2014 and 2015. And when he went to Oryx, he said, like, I'm just glad to be out of the rat race. there's a lot of pressure on the Hawks. There's a high pressure, high turnover with the Hawks coaching staff.
Right.
A lot of those guys get out of Dodge after a while because it's a pretty pressure-packed situation. They have really high expectations on the coaches. And the other thing that may be is that they also have an atypical coaching philosophy for the team. Although I think that may be more a Kimiyasu Kudo approach than a Hawks approach. And mm-hmm. the reason I say that is because the Hawks tend to let the manager decide everything.
Right.
It's also a more major league American MLB style of coaching. The Japanese guys I've talked to who've been to MLB, and particularly Akira Otsuka,
mm-hmm.
told me, not one, but many of these guys told me a similar thing. And also Termal Sledge, who I talked to, said essentially the same thing, that when you go to America and you're a coach, basically, your job number one is not telling the players how to improve, but building a relationship with the players and finding out how the player himself wants you to help him.
Mm.
And Otsuka said it's a huge difference from Japan, where basically you're so used to the players saying yes.
And yes, sir.
Exactly. that the coaches are expected to just dispense all their wisdom straight off the bat, when the players aren't really, you know, are just following, trying to paint by numbers, as opposed to having real goals in mind. You know, they're just filling in their notebooks. And,
right.
and he said in America, it don't work that way. And he thinks it, well, I got the impression he thinks it probably doesn't work that way in Japan either, but that's the Japanese mode, which is basically the players shut up and take notes, and the coaches tell them what to do.
Who are you again, old man? And what did you do? Oh, wait, yeah, okay. I guess you did something, but you're still old.
Well,
that might have worked for you, buddy, but it might not.
Well, Termal Sledge
today,
said,
that kind of stuff.
Who was coaching this year with the Chicago Cubs, said that, you know, people don't care that I played in Japan. People don't care if I'm an MVP. They don't mm-hmm. care what you did as a player. They only care, can you help me with this problem? And they are only going to ask you if they trust you. Which
exactly.
means learning how to be a good listener. And Otsuka said, this is not the norm for Japanese coaches.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So talking about game four, that was, as you said, the closest game. It ended 4-3. And a Yurisbel Gracial three-run blast in the fourth was really the big blow, but there were other problems for the Giants, and Gracial ends up being the MVP. He hit .375 in the series. He hit a two-run go-ahead home run in game one. He hit a tying home run in the third game, and then had this three-run blast in the finale.
And a bunch of, and he was just on base all the time. And
they just, you know, and I tweeted that it didn't seem like their pitching plan was working for him. And then this at bat against, you know, he went up against Giants ace Tomoyuki Sugano, who, coming off of whatever his ailments, the back and whatever he was dealing with, that they couldn't throw him at the beginning of this series, he pitched really well. And in that sequence, I was sitting at the office talking with another guy who kind of likes baseball. And I said, if I were these guys, everything they've thrown to this guy, he has hit, I would throw him four pitches off the plate. And if he gets himself out, then so be it. If he walks, so be it. And they did. It looked like Sugano was content to throw, make him chase, just like Kenta Maeda throws just sliders down and away. Mm-hmm. And he swung at a couple and missed one, or half swung at one and fouled another one off.
Only problem was he threw one in the strike zone.
But then he came back and he totally, Sugano totally missed with a pitch.
Yep.
And it was the only strike in the whole sequence.
Sure.
And it ends up near dead center out there with the cameraman. And
you felt really bad because, as you said, he was pitching really well. And he was, he and Tsuyoshi Wada, well, for different reasons, but he and Tsuyoshi Wada, the umpire Takanori Yamamoto, was giving these guys a strike zone that you could pretty much drive a motor scooter through.
Well, okay.
It was big. It was big.
I didn't see it that way.
No, it was. I mean, it was pretty generous. And
on the generous side.
And basically, Sugano was throwing everything on the outside edge of the strike zone. And he was getting strikes on him. And there were, and I mean, this was Takanori Yamamoto set his, with him and Tsuyoshi Wada, another guy who generally has really good location, hasn't for a couple of months, but did this night. It was basically an invitation to call third strikes. And these guys, Yamamoto called nine guys out on third strikes, which was a season high for him. And Yamamoto, or I should say with Tsuyoshi Wada, it was the difference was that he was throwing this first pitch slider to everybody at the bottom of the zone. And nobody's going to swing at that pitch, you know, on the first pitch because it's hard to hit.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, almost every Giants hitter started out 0-1 in the count. His changeup was not as good as it is, not as sharp as usually is, but his fastball was fairly accurate, and his slider was deadly, and it just was really, it was really tough going for both of these teams until Gracial hit that fat. It wasn't the worst. I mean, you know, it had a nice move.
It had a nice movement on it
that it kept it off the barrel of the bat. But you know what? He put a good swing on that puppy. The location was absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
And he missed the barrel of the bat. That's all I can say. He missed the barrel by about an inch, and he only drove it, you know, 15 feet past the center field wall. If he had barreled that thing up, he would have hit the scoreboard.
Yeah.
One of the scoreboard, signboards, yeah.
Broken it, yeah, in the back. So, I thought, okay, you got six strong innings from Sugano.
Yeah.
If he's really injured, why are you sending him out for another inning of a guy?
Why are you using him to hit in the fifth inning when you're down by three runs? I'm going like, okay.
I was okay with that.
Well, there was nobody on base. Yeah.
Because of the situation, but still, I just thought, you know, he has gotten through six. He's not. I mean,
you know what this is.
It's a tough call. I understand, but you're down. You're down. I mean,
sure.
This is it. So you can't.
You're down, and you have zero confidence in your bullpen. Is what it says.
That must have been what it was. That and him just wanting to lean on Sugano like he was the guy who had pitched really well early on in the season, even though he had injuries.
But he pitched admirably.
And he pitched well
for a guy with a lower back, struggling with lower back pain. I did think in the first inning he looked a little stiff. He didn't look fluid like usual, but as opposed to the last time we saw him on the mound when he couldn't throw anything where he wanted it. It was a pleasure to watch him pitch, and Wada came out and looked like Tsuyoshi Wada also. So from that aspect, this was really a fun game to see two guys who really know what they're doing to actually go out there and do it.
Yeah. So like I said, yeah, he looked good. I just probably, if it were me, I would have said thank you, you know, and then just gone one by one with the batters to get through whatever innings you had to get through until you had complete desperation situation. But you know, Hada sent him back out there, and it, again, another error was involved, and
another error by
your buddy Yamamoto.
By my buddy Yamamoto, he's now at second base, and the first touch after he comes in as a defensive replacement, it's an error, and it's a crucial run. Not the big blow, but a crucial run. It's a one-run game, and he makes it a two-run game.
Correct, and that run ends up being the winning margin, because the Giants did score one more run, made it 4-3. But they lose, and my whole wrap-up of this whole series was that, like I said in the beginning, I thought it just seemed to go by in three games. It was a three-game sweep in four, and I just didn't see a lot of do-or-die in the approach from the Giants, and quite frankly, they deserved to be swept if they were going to play like that. And you had these players like Sakamoto and Maru who just were not producing, but the Giants didn't move them in the lineup. They didn't change anything. They just waited for them to hit.
Yeah, this
and they didn't.
This series reminded me of the 2002 Japan series between the Giants and the Cebu Lions, in the sense that the Lions had a chance. They opened the series with a runner on first base. Kazuo Matsui was there, and they tried to sacrifice him to second, as the Lions did under Haruki Ihara, and second-year catcher Shinosuke Abe kind of made a risky throw to second base to gun down the runner. And that was basically the end of the series for the Lions. It essentially ended in the top of the first inning at Tokyo Dome.
Wow.
And yeah, because what happened was the Giants were just motivated, and the Lions were like going, you know, Ihara was a by-the-book guy. He had a plan, and he followed his plan, and the plan wasn't working, and he stuck with the plan until the last game. You know, he did a lot of weird stuff, and I think it rubbed off on the team. And by I mean weird stuff, he had Daisuke Matsuzaka batting eighth, which is okay. I don't have a problem with Daisuke Matsuzaka batting eighth, but apparently
it's certainly weird for Japan. Yeah,
it makes sense actually. It's actually a good move.
Something new.
But the point was, he had him swinging away in a bunt situation, the word came out that it was on the orders of the Cebu Lions owner that Matsuzaka was batting eighth. I take that back. And it was also under the, you know, a lot of things. So it's sort of like, and also he was playing, he had a bunch of foreign guys. He had Scott McLean, who had some pop. He had basically three guys who had pop on that lineup. Well, Alex Cabrera, I guess four, Kazuo Matsui, Scott McLean, and Kazuhiro Wada, except he kept Scott McLean on the bench.
Okay.
And so he went in with, and it's sort of like he was going to show, if you know Haruki Ihara, he's a bit of a nationalist kind of guy. I'm going to show people how good Japanese baseball is. And he did it by sort of keeping his foreigners in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Until he finally wheeled them out, I think in game three or game four, and game three, and they finally produced, and it was like, okay, but the Lions were the lack of motivation from Hara reminds me very much of the sort of, it looked like the Lions looked like they got hit on the head by a hammer in the first game, and they never quite got over it. like they were concussed. And that series looked very much like this. It's like they ran into a buzzsaw and they just went like, oh, we're gone. We're goners here.
Yeah, that's one of the other highlights I did not mention until then, but that the Hawks won 10 consecutive postseason games. They lost that first game to the Rakuten Eagles in the first round of the Climax.
Yes.
And then went on to win every game.
They've also won 8 straight Japan Series games since they lost game 2.
There's so many numbers. Oh, since they lost game 2 wins.
Last year, they lost. Yeah, they tied the first game.
They won a bunch at home, right? Like 14.
Yeah, they've now won 14 straight games at home.
Dome. Yeah, so there's lots of numbers we could play with. But anyway, the Giants lose, and right after that, Scott Matheson, the right-hander friend of the program, announces that he's retiring from professional ball. He's still going to play for Canada. And there, I saw a lot on Twitter, there were a lot of little highlights of him talking with teammates, meeting with the media for the initial announcement, and then his press conference. So that was all nice, and of course we wish him the best. And we didn't get a chance to talk to him. That's why we don't have any guests on the show this week. We were trying to get catch up with him, but it didn't work out. So the Giants lose, and then immediately, I think it was Thursday, I saw a story in Sports Hochi or something about the Giants mentioning the fact that there's a huge difference in the rosters because of the DH rule that the Pacific League has, and that he really felt that gave them, or they had an advantage with that. And of course, I know they had Christian Villanueva no matter how they felt about him batting wise, and they had some options. They just didn't turn to those options in Fukuoka when they were down there for the DH. But I did bring it up because it was something I saw in game one, that the Giants had this situation on the roster.
But Giants are making it sound like the DH was just invented last year.
Hashtag.
You know, like
or that no Central League team will ever win because they don't have a DH on the roster.
Well, first of all, the Giants had a DH. His name's Shinosuke Abe, so that's not a problem. And he's still as good as can be. I mean, he's...
Well, but what I mean by that is exactly what I said last week. By putting him in as a DH, now you lose a really high-quality pinch hitter
who has
been good for you this year. Well, I mean, my point saying that he has been in a certain role, and now the 4 at-bats and getting him with more at-bats might be good, but now who do you bring off the bench in a key situation who's a veteran player who you can count on to at least have a good at-bat up there? And that, when you look around on the roster, that person didn't exist.
Alex Guerrero?
From the left side then.
Okay. We'll get there.
I mean, that's what I mean. I mean, a guy you can replace the Abe bat with.
Okay.
Essentially. So I understand.
I think it's a tiny thing. It's such a small thing. And the Giants are a team that does have a big bat off the bench. I think you're making too much of the fact that he's a left-handed bat and he has to be a veteran bat and blah, 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 blah.
Well, my point is, my point is that you had a really good quality pinch hitter who was really successful for you this year, and now he's in the lineup, and then when you put him there, there is no one else on that roster who can match that kind of
production.
That's why I brought it up on the show.
I know.
It's not that they didn't have a DH, it's that they don't have a DH on the roster. And they have to use someone who comes out of what their production value has been the whole season and has a new role.
Well,
and whether you know, he could have hit 4 home runs, I would have said the same thing. They still don't have a DH on the roster.
Okay, I think,
and that's my point.
I will respectfully disagree, but I also think that as with things with baseball,
how the creatures of habit and people getting
how
excited.
People feel,
mm-hmm. yeah,
is often has nothing to do with what makes sense and rationale, you know, it's like,
right.
You know, you could bat the pitcher second and it would affect it, make essentially no difference. It would make very tiny incremental difference in your offense. Although actually second, you could probably bat him third. It would have a smaller impact. But the point is that people are upset by little things. and I mean this, people are upset. Oh, I shouldn't, you know, I'm a number four hitter. I should be batting fourth and not sixth. People not are upset, but can be upset. People can be thrown off by really trivial, and I'll say trivial things. I mean, it's trivial. Yeah. It's trivial in the big picture, but it's not trivial to them.
Right. So, you've got superstition. You've got, like I said, creatures of habit, sure, and just things thrown off in a high pressure situation.
It's why people don't want to see pitchers batting eighth, even if it makes more sense to have your pitcher bat eighth than it does ninth. Right. People don't like to see it because it's, you know, oh, this is not what we do. So I think, as much as I disagree from a logical standpoint, I will agree that that could have, that that might have been a factor.
And I don't think it, you know, for me, like I said, I don't think it was that big a deal. And it's not like Central League teams in the past, you know, had a disadvantage because they were constructed the same back in the day. It's just, you know, this league right now is superior. It's better.
Yeah.
And you've got to, I think you got to manage with more desperation. I wouldn't blame it on not having a DH, but I won't be surprised to see that talk pick up in the offseason here about the, you know, having a DH rule in the Central League as well, or getting rid of it in the Pacific League, one or the other.
I think the Giants want the DH now.
Well, obviously,
But again, here's the point. It's like, oh, well, we couldn't win. You guys didn't have any trouble winning the Japan Series from 1975 to 2004, but
right,
from, you know, to 2002. But all of a sudden, when you run into a tough spot, we got to have the DH because it's a difference. Well, to be honest, I think there is a difference because most, you know, I've seen like Central League teams do like some National League teams have done in the World Series. And, you know, I remember, do you remember the hard throwing shortstop for the Chicago Cubs who went ahead of Dwight Gooden in the draft?
Oh, Sean Dunstan.
Sean Dunstan, right. At the end of his career, and I believe this was the World Series in which the Giants lost to the Anaheim Angels at that time. Mm-hmm. And Sean Dunstan was their DH. And he really couldn't, he was pretty useless. He would have been better to have him as the coach that he eventually became, but he was eventually useless. He was the guy on the bench who wasn't as bad a hitter as a pitcher. And right. I mean, in the 1999 Japan Series, we saw the Chunichi Dragons pulling out basically utility infielder to be their DH. And I'm going,
yeah,
like,
Gino, yeah,
exactly. And that's the team. Those are the teams who should have problems with the DH.
Right.
And
right,
that is on occasion a problem. We've seen those kind of guys who really shouldn't be playing, shouldn't really have a bat in their, you shouldn't be paid to have a bat in their hand up there. So
yes,
that should be a problem. But making a big deal about it, oh, like it changes your team dynamic. Again, I think that's a trivial thing, but people do, you know, people say players aren't random number, as Deanna Rubin is fond of saying, players are not random number generators, they're human beings. Yeah. And people react in ways that are unpredictable.
Yeah, well, Hara finally had the desperation. It was just after the series was over. and I know you've told me this before, that Japan likes to mimic the majors in the rule changes. So I think until the majors actually make that rule change, whether they get rid of it in the American League or add it to the National League, I question how seriously MPB will consider a change. But you know, if the Giants want something, I wouldn't be surprised to see more discussion about it. I don't expect a change.
I think if the Giants really wanted it, what they would do is say, we're going to quit the Central League and form a new league with the Pacific League, who they're kind of quasi-partners with anyway. I'm not kidding.
Right.
And then the rest of the Central League teams will say, okay, well, we don't want that. We don't want it to be, you know, the Hanshin Tigers.
Get out of here. Just go do it.
Well, you know,
then
the Hanshin Tigers
later,
and the Giants are basically... would probably right now prefer to be in the Pacific League. And, you know, who cares about, you know, they've spent the last 40 years talking about how more traditional the Central League is. But you know the Giants would dump the Central League in a dumpster.
In a heartbeat.
they would dump their colleagues in a dumpster and leave a ransom note if they thought it was in their best interest for 10 minutes.
All right, and with that, let's make a four-seam transition and talk about the Sawamura Award that wasn't. Now, the player who won the award was none of the above.
Indeed.
And that was the first time in 19 years that there was no awarding of the Sawamura. But, you know, Jason Koskrie, I think he kind of went off at you or to you, and then he wrote a column that I actually wasn't able to see because my... on Twitter, whenever I would click onto it, it kept saying that I had reached my limit as a non-subscriber to the Japan Times, and he didn't have it in the paper, so I never got to see it. But I did talk to him about it, and essentially he was angry, and I was surprised because
he was motivated. He was more motivated about the Sawamura Award than Haro was to manage in the Japan series, I think.
There you go. But yeah, I didn't, you know, I had seen in recent years that the more the committee got together and said, well, this guy hasn't reached the benchmarks that we have, but we're going to give him the award, but we want him to work on these things. We want him to concentrate and focus and do the, I mean, they would send a note home with the award.
Yeah, pretty much. You have your mother sign this kind of thing.
Right. I mean, even a long time ago with Darvish, it was that, yeah, he's pitching really well, but he has a tendency to give up runs early in the games in the first inning.
Oh, you name it. You name it. We want him to try harder to be like this. And so he did enlist. And he was, Jason, he didn't include this in his story, he said, but he thought that Manabu Kitabepu, a former Carp ace, was among the presenters, one of the younger guys on the committee, was very positive about guys who probably should have won the award. But it has to be a unanimous decision.
Right. And so, you know, I'm looking at the way that they have these benchmarks, which includes things like strikeouts and complete games.
150
and winning
strikeouts and 200
right.
innings
well,
and 10
these,
complete games.
Mm-hmm. Some of these things are either going to just be harder and harder to achieve because the game has changed now from what it was years ago, and that you don't have guys, you know, you could be throwing a shutout or a one hitter or a two hitter, and they take you out of a game for the ninth inning, no matter who you are. And the strikeouts, especially in Japan, with guys trying more and more to put the ball in play as opposed to the major leagues where they're really concentrated and focused on launch angle and hitting home runs. They're just trying to get the ball in play here, so the strikeouts are getting harder. You've got the winning percentage. Well, I mean,
I don't know.
I don't know if they are getting harder in terms of that, but it just seems like to me that guys are not changing the swings like they do in the States.
No, so, no, it is. Yeah. The strikeouts are not jumping like they are in the majors, but
no. And so we've got, and then as we talked about this past season, the bullpens. You know, you've got some bullpens, some questionable relief pitchers out there, and you can leave with a 3-run lead in the seventh inning and end up coming away with no decision because the bullpen eventually blew your lead. So the winning percentages and the number of wins, all those things are impacted by things that are out of the starting pitcher's control unless he's out there trying to finish off his own complete game and en route to doing it, striking out a lot of guys. So I think it really has changed. So when I was talking to Jason, he said, look, these old guys really need to decide if the NPB award is going to mimic the Cy Young or if it's really just going to be something in which they say you were most like Eiji Sawamura and in this case we're going to give you this award because you've reached most of these benchmarks. But it can't, Jason's last words to me were, it can't be both anymore.
No, agreed.
You can't do that because, in my opinion, the game is changing too much and you can't represent both. And, you know, there were some pitchers who probably were deserving of being recognized as the best for the year. But, yeah, they might not have reached the the benchmarks for the Sawamura Award. So what do you do? So
again, no, that's a good opinion.
They have a quandary.
I think that's a good opinion. It's an interesting point. And I think, yes, I mean, do you keep the Sawamura Award as a museum? You know, as a museum award, this guy is a throwback. You know, call it the Sawamura Throwback Award. Because that's what it is essentially now. These guys don't. And I said to Jason in a text that, well, of course, Tsuneo Horiuchi, who never hesitated to have an opinion or share his opinion about how he knows how the world works, said that it's all the put all the blame on Americanism in Japanese baseball. And he said, you know, Japanese, rightly enough, he said Japanese pitchers, you know, they start once a week now.
Right.
So they could probably pitch more than 100 pitch. They could throw more than 100 pitches. But I will also say that's the conundrum. That's the problem that happened to Japanese pitchers from about 35 years ago till about 20 years ago, is that they were basically given unlimited pitch counts, and the toll on the arms from the mid-80s to the mid, you know, until 2000 was just horrendous. I mean, it was was a meat grinder. Going to a Japanese baseball game was like watching you know, a physical abuse, like a demolition derby kind of thing for pitchers. So,
right.
That was a problem. And the other thing is that I would, whenever these guys come up and say essentially that the pitchers these days are not worthy of being mentioned in the same sentence as we were, that they should in fact turn it around and say, well, we're sorry, but the game is too difficult now. It's much harder now to do the things we did, because the game is harder. And
not our old snow.
No. But I'm just saying, this is the truth. The reason these guys, well, part of it is, so my point is this: it's much harder now to do the things they did for a variety of reasons. One is the talent of the next level of the competition between the pitchers is much harder. It's much harder to be a standout pitcher when the next guy is only, you know, half a percentage, you know, you're only a half a percent as good as the next five guys. Mm-hmm. So the talent is more compressed and better. The hitters are better. The game has changed. Okay, to some degree, that's true. Okay, so there's that. One is recognize that, you know, and say, okay, we're going to change it. You know, I think Jason's idea has a lot of merit. You know, we'll have one for each league, and it's the best pitcher. And then if you want to throw a Sawamura on top of that, fine. Okay, the throwback of Ward. And the other point is this. Basically, they're saying to the teams, we want you, okay, now the game is the way it is. And the game is the way it is not because it's becoming Americanized. The game is the way it is because the managers and the teams are doing their best to maximize their resources to win games. Right? That's why they use a closer in the ninth inning. That's why they use a middle relief pitcher. That's why they limit the number of, they keep an eye on the pitch counts, because they're trying to keep their players healthy and win more games. And the Sawamura Committee is saying, the Sawamura Award Committee is saying, stop that nonsense about winning games. You guys should remember that this is Japanese baseball, and part of Japan is not about doing what's best. It's about doing what the old people tell you you should do to be an homage to the past, because that's the real baseball that we played, and not that stuff you're doing now. So stop trying to win so much, and instead, you know,
look at the important stuff.
Yeah, do the important things, like throwing 200 pitches in a game and striking out 15 guys in a game.
Or at least trying.
Yeah, at least trying, exactly. We want you to stop this nonsense about thinking about what's best for your team and focus on developing star players.
And the theme that we'll be chasing that down with is, you know, not every team can win, so you just got to go out and put up numbers.
Yeah, exactly. I guess if you've got a guy like the late, great Masaichi Kaneda, who plays for a really terrible team, I mean a historically bad team, yeah, let him win every game for him. So right. I guess. All right. Okay. But yeah, Jason, yeah, good thinking. I think absolutely. I mean, they cannot have it both ways, but they want to see, they want to somehow change people's belief that the old ways are the best for Japan, that we're Japanese are somehow special. I mean, there's a little bit of that sort of nationalistic kind of ultra right wing kind of thinking in there, that we're different. We should have a different standards for our baseball.
Okay. All right, let's make a two-seam transition. And last week I asked listeners to chime in with their best moments or highlights from the season, and we got a few from a number of listeners. And now I'm going to lead off with our own Michael Westbay. And he sent me an email at about 11 o'clock tonight. I just happened to be looking at the email and I saw it, otherwise we wouldn't have gotten it in. But Michael says, for me, the most memorable game of the season was the Bay Stars comeback against the Carp at Yokohama Stadium on September 19th. And Neftali Soto and Takayuki Kajitani combined for 11 RBIs. And after the team was trailing 7-0 through five innings, they came back and won 11-8. And it was reminiscent of the Yoshitomo Tsugo, Jose Lopez, Toshiro Miyazaki back-to-back-to-back homers for a sayonara victory 2 years earlier against the Carp. And that helped propel the Bay Stars to the playoffs. So that was the game for him. For Coaster Freak, our buddy, he says the slugger Takaya Nakamura's 400th home run was one of his highlights. But he does have a soft spot. And I don't remember what game that was. And I was going to look it up. But I'm sorry, Coaster Freak, I did not have time. But I did look up the game that you referenced second, which was a game that you saw. He says he saw at Nagoya Dome when Nakamura had a clutch hit in the ninth off Ono. But the actual situation was that Nakamura had a clutch home run in the seventh inning on June 19th against Ono. So it wasn't in the ninth inning, it was in the seventh inning. It was on June 19th, and that was the game-winning RBI. But, you know, details. And then ZZ via Twitter wrote in and said when he was visiting Japan in March/April, he was able to attend opening day in Hiroshima, and he saw a number of games, but the most memorable game for him was opening day, March 29th at Hiroshima at Mazda Stadium. Hiroshima wins the game 5-0, and Yoshihiro Maru comes back in his return after leaving the Carp as a free agent in the offseason and strikes out 4 times in the loss for the Yomiuri Giants. So that was his memorable game. And then another friend of the program, Glenn, sent by email, he said for him it was the home run by Fumihito Haraguchi, his return from battling cancer, August 4th game. And then they lost. The Tigers lost to Hiroshima 10-5, but Haraguchi hit a home run in his return.
I know.
And that was at Koshien, I believe, so...
Yeah, the Tigers had like 10 teams worth of memorable moments at the end of that season as they, you know, just clung to life game after game after game after game. It was really fun. It was really fun to watch.
That game was at Mazda Stadium.
Okay.
So, yeah. And I know for me, I thought he had a, I believe it was in June, because I remember Haraguchi coming back and having all kinds of, you know, fan support, and, you know, he had gone through a lot of treatment, and I just remember him coming back.
He had surgery, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, I remember Haraguchi getting a walk-off hit on June 9th to beat Nippon Ham 4-3, and I thought that was a bigger hit for him than the August home run, but yeah. They're both big hits in his career for sure, and I do remember those. And in fact, that was one of the guys I was looking at in terms of for me. But what about you, Jim?
As far as the play, as a play in a game, my favorite baseball play of the season was the April 20th bottom of the first inning at Koshien Stadium, Tigers and Giants, and Koji Chikamoto, our amazing rookie center fielder for the Hanshin Tigers. I say our amazing. I mean our as in baseball.
He belongs to us. We're
as among baseball fans. Yeah.
Yes.
Rookie center fielder of the Hanshin Tigers reaches on a single to short. And when Giants first baseman Kazuma Okamoto is far behind the bag and makes this high arcing throw to second to the pitcher, to Taylor Youngman on the mound, Chikamoto takes off for second, so he steals second base on the first baseman, and the scorers did not record it as if they didn't know what to record it at. It's not anything.
Right.
it wasn't on the same. He didn't get a double. He wasn't credited with a stolen base. I have no idea how they eventually did this, but he was just granted second base because Okamoto was being careless with the ball. And then Taylor Youngman threw the ball into, bounced the throw, threw it into center field, and Koji Okamoto essentially had an infield triple. So that was my favorite play of the game.
On the throw.
Because it was just alert, sharp, clever base running. Love it.
So kind
of
rookie.
Yeah, and it's something we don't see enough of, you know, because baseball is such a preordained. I'll go back to my favorite moment of the Japan series, which was when Rick Vandenhert came up to bunt in game three, and he didn't square to bunt on the first pitch. And you could tell the Giants were like going, what is this pitcher's hitting thing you speak of, Spartacus?
the computer's not working.
I know, exactly. The pitching coach had to come out to the mound to settle down the infield after the pitcher didn't do what he was supposed to do. So, I love that. I love that play. And my favorite moment in terms of what I'll remember, and John hit this one right on the head, was the September 23rd exit for Kazuya Fukuura of the Lotte Marines when, you know, he hasn't played a game. He comes in, he starts the game for the Marines as their DH, and he goes 0-for-4. And then in the ninth inning, they put him at first base. And it's just sort of an innocuous little thing, you know, like a last honor to their aging veteran, iconic veteran. And how does the game end? But he dives to catch a line drive for the final out of the final inning of the final game of his career. And it was, you couldn't have planned it. They couldn't have planned it. They didn't plan it, but it happened. So it was just magical. And that's what I will never forget about the 2019 season.
All right. And for me, we had... I always pick a play or a circumstance that kind of reflects the season. And I think we talked about it on the show all season long, and that we had so many blown leads, especially with the bullpens. So my game was June 16th at Zozo Marine Stadium. That's another one involving the Marines. And it was a 6-run ninth inning by the Marines against the Dragons. And it was an interleague matchup, obviously. And the reason it was memorable for me was twofold. One, Daichi Suzuki, who just seems to be involved in every big play offensively that the Marines have when they need someone to get a hit or need someone to do something. He just seems to be involved, whether he's getting the hit or he's on base and scoring the run or however he's involved, he's there. He started this rally with a home run, and he ended the home run, the rally with his second hit of the inning, and it was a single to get the winning runs home. So that was one. And the other thing was that I remembered from this game was just before I changed the channel, before all the runs started scoring, was that the Dragon Shuhei Takahashi was chasing after a foul ball in that inning. And he went near the rails, and I think he had a play that could have been made, and it would have been tough, but he didn't make it. And he jogged back to his position in the field because they had a 6-run lead. He had a smile on his face. I missed that. And, snapped a photo of that and then checked back later about 20 minutes when the inning is still going because they didn't get that out. They end up losing the game. And so, like I said, because we had so many blown leads, that was the one, because I think that was the one, the biggest comeback late in a game. Now, Michael Westbay talked about the fact that the Bay Stars came from seven runs down, but that was over the course of the game. This was in the last inning with the backs against the wall, and it just kind of reflects all the blown leads that we saw. So that was my moment of the season, among some others. But that's the one I'm going to go with here. So let's go to fielding questions. So we've got an MP3 from our buddy Mike in DC.
Hey, John and Jim. Not to reopen any old wounds around talking about the Most Valuable Player Award, but I was wondering, if you were able to set out statistical milestones that determine the MVP, kind of like MPB does with the Sauer Moore Award, what stats would you pick? Would it just be WAR plus, you know, game-winning hits? Would it be just some combination of total value times team's win-loss record? I'd love to hear what your ideal set of metrics for the MVP would be, with trepidation. Thanks, guys.
I love how that rhymes. Mm-hmm. All right, Jim, what do you got?
Trepidation. Lots of trepidation.
I know that guy.
Do you? No, that's Trepidation the Third.
Okay.
Okay. What do I use? I don't have a standard. I kind of have a toolbox, a variety of things I looked at. Basically, my belief is I just try to find the guy who contributed to the most wins. His contributions led to the most wins. That's what I'm trying to get to. Okay. And if I have two guys who I think are close, who are reasonably close, and I can't choose, you know, which of these guys, then I'll go with if and then one of them won a pennant. Yeah, that's important. And it's important to me because that's the goal. You know, that's the goal, is winning the pennant. So you do get extra credit for that. I mean, I know who was the Central League leader in WAR, and I didn't I look at WAR, I look at win shares, I look at WOBA. I generally don't pick pitchers as MVPs because I just don't. It's just not that game. It's not the Sawa Mura era game anymore. So I think about him. Having said that, I did vote for Masahiro Tanaka in 2013. So
and I think I did too. And I explained my reasons was because he pitched once a week, but his impact on the team was more than once a week he pitched deep into games and gave the bullpen a rest. And impacted the way the manager could use his relief pitchers with other guys on the mound. So he was the most.
In my mind, he wasn't. But I thought, well, he also won the pennant. So okay.
Well, okay, you can't pick him then.
No.
Anyway, go ahead.
No, I'm saying I mean, in terms of how many wins he contributed to, I didn't have him as absolutely the top. But he was close enough that, you know, he won the pennant. So okay. Give them an extra credit. The reason I do that is because there are many things we just don't know. You know, we don't know what he contributed to the team that isn't in, you know, what he went to do to make that team a better team, what he did to make his teammates better teammates. We have no idea of knowing. And so if a team wins the pennant, it means, you know, it not necessarily that things went right, but things that went wrong didn't. And he was a part of the process, so I'm going to give him a little shadow credit for that. So,
okay. All right, for me, now obviously Mike is a longtime friend of the program and listener, and he goes back to the first year of JBW when we had the great MVP discussion of 2011.
Yeah, discussion. Let's call it a discussion.
You tried to, well, whatever. We just never speak of it again. Anyway,
and that's the trepidation.
You and I won't, but right. But I'm sure Mike has heard this story before, but I'll tell it again to the newer listeners, and I'll be brief. I played in a basketball league with a running clock, and I averaged 30 points a game in this basketball league, and mostly because of my teammates. They couldn't pass, they couldn't dribble, and they couldn't shoot. So I just had to take on those responsibilities. And at the end of the season, when we were 0-whatever, or 1-9, or whatever we were, I was awarded the MVP honor. And it just rang hollow for me because we didn't win anything. And I look at these the way that Japan tries to figure out, or doesn't, I wouldn't even say they try to figure out, they just add home runs to RBIs and they have their little, you know, 1+1=MVP. But I think you can't, I mean, for me, I don't think there's a metric out there that I would trust to say, well, this guy is the MVP because I don't see it that way. I knew that the guys I was playing with, they counted on me to do more than score points, but the only thing that could be measured in this league basically was the points. But I got rebounds, I played defense, I blocked shots, I got a lot of steals, I dished out assists, but all they did was count the points. And I don't think it's that easy. I don't think you just look at the numbers. If there were some formula out there, you know, hits in clutch situations, in, you know, in games that the team won and blah, 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 and there were metrics, then it would just be a math exercise. And I don't think it's that simple. Of course, both of us, Jim and I, are old school guys, so I don't think we're going to go to a metric to figure out the MVP. I don't think we ever will. I think part of it for me is why I watch so many games and try to pay attention to so many games, is because I want to see who has that hidden impact. Who's the guy who, in his at-bat in the fifth inning, really did try to move the runner over because that was best for the team, and then in the seventh inning, got the big hit that they were looking for, and then in the ninth inning, came up and added an extra run on with another hit or a sacrifice fly. Those are important too, and you know, people look for the sexy things. The sacrifice fly definitely is not sexy, but it can be important in a game where you put that second run up there, that insurance run up there before your team goes up and tries to get the last three outs in the bottom of an inning. So yeah, I know it's not sexy and all that stuff, but catching the ball is extremely important. And it seems to me that it always comes last.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want a one-dimensional or a guy who just has a bat and that's it. I want to see guys play defense. And that's why I really was impressed with Takeya Nakamura this year, because he was solid. And I say solid in saying that I never want to use that word because it's not very good, but he was a very capable and credible defensive player this year for his team, and impacted his team in so many ways, not just hitting home runs, but those are the easy things to count. So for me, it's not a math exercise, and I'm not going to ever do a stat geek thing where I say, oh, well, this is how I'm going to add up all the numbers, game-winning hits plus home runs and average and RBIs and all this stuff, and that's the best player. Because you know, you can be a really good player on a bad team. And, you know, if, like Jim said, that's what I do too. If I get two players whose numbers I look at and whose contributions I estimate to be about the same, then yeah, if your team finished a little bit higher, I'm assuming you had some part of the leadership in the locker room and helping some of the other guys come through, because, you know, we don't want to give credit to the leaders, but you look at a guy like Shinosuke Abe, and he makes the guys better around him because he pushes himself and he pushes them as well to do the extra things, or to work a little bit harder, or to think a little bit more in the game and the batter's box.
That's good. I mean, Scott Matheson and Casey McGee told me they called Abe a baseball genius, and I thought about that because you don't, you know, it's hard to tell, but
it's hard to see it. You can't see.
Yeah, but it's something. But what people said is, you know, Garrett Jones said, you know, it was so. Who was, you know. When I talked to foreign players, you know, who's helped you settle in? And I was expecting him to say, oh, you know, the foreign hitters, the other hitters in the league. And no, he says, no, Shinosuke Abe, because we're different kind of hitters, but he helped me adjust my swing to deal with Japanese baseball. And Casey McGee and Scott Matheson called him a baseball genius. And all I could think of is the many ways he's a guy who possesses many different perspectives on the game and can communicate those so that other people can understand them. And to me, that's a really unique skill. Now, I'm more of a stat geek than John is, in the sense that I like to know as much as I can.
Quantify it.
Well, I want to quantify what I can, but I don't want to throw out what I can't. Wins matter, absolutely.
Yes,
but
definitely.
On the other hand, I'm gonna try. I don't want to penalize a guy because I don't want to penalize the best player in the league because he's playing on the worst team in the league.
Right. Okay. And I've heard, I've heard guys in across a number of sports saying, well, I'm not going to pick that guy. His team is bad. And I'm like, well, what does that have to do with him being an MVP or an All-Star?
Yeah, exactly.
Still a great player.
Right, exactly. So
why are you penalizing him?
Yeah, I know.
The guys around him in the front office can't figure out how to put quality players around.
You know, here's another thing about that is it's good that people have different opinions because we learn from each. You know, I used to be of the school that, well, if I can't measure it, I'm just going to ignore it. And mm-hmm. and that's not a very ethical approach. It's a simple approach, but it requires a kind of suspension of disbelief, just like it requires a suspension of disbelief that, you know, whoever has the most RBIs is the best guy at driving in runs. And, you know, we know it isn't true. It isn't necessarily true. Lots of things aren't necessarily true. So when you have many people looking at different areas and discussing them. And this is what I wish there was more of in Japan, a discussion instead of this guy's the MVP because he has the most RBIs, but this guy's the MVP because he was the captain on the winning team. And I did, and I think, you know, when a guy is expected to be the leader, and John's talked about this, you know, when you're expected to be the guy on the spot and you do win a championship, that's a little more too. You know, lots of things going on that we really don't have a finger on. So, and I make guesses. I mean, I don't know. I don't have some of my numbers that I usually have this year, but.
So that's a lot of time spent to say, no, we don't have a metric. So
no, sorry. No, nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Move along.
But I hope that you know that I watch a lot. I listen to a lot. If there's a game on, I'm certainly tuned in.
Yeah, John watches to so much baseball that when he turns on the TV says, are you kidding me? Baseball again.
The TV says, which game do you want when I turn it on?
All of them.
I say, split the screen.
Give me six.
Split the screen up. Give them all to me. All right. Now, we've got Premier 12 baseball that will keep us busy, but we will start on our off-season program schedule at some point soon, but I think we got games coming up this weekend, so we will be back next week, and we've got MVP and all kinds of fun awards to talk about coming up here soon, so we will talk to you next week. Enjoy your off-season.
See you at the Premier 12, I hope.